left.
Okay. The departure point for this year is basically a Rashi, two-word Rashi, in Parshat Vayera, where when it's talking about when Lot serves his guests, who are of course angels, when they come to the house, it says, "Umatzot afa vayochelu." He baked matzot and they ate. To which Rashi, quoting the Medrash, says, "Matzot afa, why Pesach hayah?" It's Pesach. Anachronisms aside, the questions about how it could be Pesach if he's talking about what's going to happen for another 400 years, how, you know, did the Avos keep the mitzvahs, etc., 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 all irrelevant for the time being. I want to explore connections between the destruction of stone specifically and the beginning of Parshat Vayera in general and Yetzias Mitzrayim as a way of deepening our understanding of Yetzias Mitzrayim and what we're supposed to be experiencing at the Seder. Years after I prepared this year, I came across this Haggadah by my mentor and former my former employer, Rabbi David Silber, founder of the Drusha Institute in New York. Wonderful Haggadah if you're looking to add to your collection, which was put out last year by JPS. And he has an essay called "Lot and the Destruction of Sodom: A Prefiguring of the Exodus." I've given this slightly sexier title called "The Prequel to the Exodus." He analyzes many interesting parallels between the destruction of Sodom and Yetzias Mitzrayim, almost none of which I'm going to touch on in this year. I was a bit of relief when I read that, but he has many, many interesting things to say. A very, very worthwhile Haggadah to add to your Seder collection. I really want to do an in-depth analysis, as much time as we have, an in-depth analysis of the first section of Parshas Vayera, and then use that analysis to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. The first section of Parshas Vayera encompasses all of Parakim Yud Chet and Yud Tet. It's the longest unbroken section we have in the first half of Sefer Bereishit, and it encompasses a number of stories that don't necessarily seem to be connected to each other. Namely, the Malachim come and foretell the birth of Yitzhak. They come and Avram thinks they're people. He invites them in. He gives them food. Then they ask where Sarah. Sarah's in the tent, and they announce that Yitzhak is going to be born. That's one. That's the beginning of the parsha. That sort of stands on its own. There seems to be no connection between that and what happens afterwards, which is that those same angels go down to Sodom en route to destroy Sodom. Avram is told by God that he's going to destroy Sodom. Avram argues with God, back and forth, back and forth. The angels go down to Sodom. Lot invites them in. The townspeople surround the house. Lot negotiates with them. Eventually, the angels decide they're going to destroy Sodom. They tell Lot to flee. They destroy Sodom. And the end of the story, of course, is Lot and his daughters go. They flee to the mountains. His wife turns around and becomes a pillar of salt. His daughters think they're the only people left in the world, and they get him drunk and are impregnated by him. What does the announcement of the birth of Yitzhak have to do with the rest of the story, aside from the apparently coincidental fact that it happens to be the same angels who tell Avram and Sarah they're going to have a child and also go and destroy Sodom? What's the connection between the two? That's a sort of larger thematic question that I want to address. On a textual level, this parsha stands out for a number of interesting features that we don't normally think about when we read Tanakh. There was a wonderful essay by a German Jewish scholar of literature named Eric Auerbach, who fled Nazi Germany in the late 30s, ended up in Turkey of all places. And while he was in Turkey, he wrote a book called Mimesis, the Representation of Literature, Representation of Reality in Western Literature. And the first essay in the book is called Odysseus's Scar. Why does this interest us at all? Because he contrasts the episode of Odysseus's Scar in the Odyssey, where Odysseus, disguised as a beggar, comes back to his home after 20 years abroad, fighting the Trojan War, and then getting lost and having various adventures. He's in disguise because he's about to kill all of Penelope's suitors, but his maid, who's washing his feet, feels his scar that he was on his leg that he got when he was a boy. Suddenly she realizes this is Odysseus, on and on. Eric Auerbach contrasts the style in which Homer tells that episode with, of all things, Akedas Yitzchak. Interesting comparison, and kind of makes many, many fascinating insights into the style in which the Chumash tells the stories. One of the distinctive features of Tanakh and the narrative style of Tanakh is there's very little detail. We're never told, almost never told, what people were wearing, what they were eating, where they were sitting, what was the weather like outside, etc., etc., etc. We have to fill in all those details. And when you see stories from Tanakh dramatized, as in the Ten Commandments, the Prince of Egypt, they fill in all those details in sometimes dubious ways. Of all of the stories in Sefer Bereishit, I think this series of episodes stands out for having the most physical detail. We're told what Abraham served the Malachim, we're told what Lot served the Malachim, we're told what the weather was outside, what type of day Abraham was sitting outside. We're told what physical structures they were living in and sitting near. And there's a sequence of these structures. There's Abraham and Sarah's tent, there's Lot's house, and finally the cave in which Lot and his daughters end up at the end of the story. That sequence in and of itself is fascinating. This is very rarely do we have any sense of the physical setting in which the characters are sitting. And here we have a sequence of three such settings: the tent, the house, the cave. Moreover, in each of those settings, or at least in the first two, there is not just a structure, but also a door that features prominently in the story, or a doorway. When the Malachim ask, "Where's Sarah? Where is where?" What does Abraham respond? She's in the tent. And then when they announce that Yitzchak is going to be born, where is she? The Sarah Shamat Petachal. She's listening at the doorway of the tent. When Lot goes out to placate the townspeople, when they surround his house and demand that he send out his guests so they can sodomize them, hence the term sodomize, he steps into the doorway, into the petach, the hadelat sagar acharav, and closes the door behind him. Again, Sarah and Lot both standing in the doorway. What does all this mean? What does this signify on a literary level? I think it's not coincidental. I think we can agree that when the Chumash puts in details, the whole point of Auerbach's essay is to say when the Chumash puts in details, those details are significant. They've got to be significant. I like to use the analogy of those who've seen Schindler's List, the red coat. Do you know the red coat? All right, there's this one little girl who's wearing a red coat. And the movie's in black and white, except for the coat. The coat is the only image in the movie that is in red. And why is it in red? He wants you to notice the coat the first time it appears, because later on it shows up, I think, in the concentration camp in a pile of coats, and to give you a sense of the fate of this little girl. A little heavy-handed, a little clumsy, but you get the point. When the Chumash mentions details, they're in color. They're painted red. They stand out for a reason. What's the significance of the physical structure? Let's start with Sarim. There's a Rashi earlier on in Bereishit when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling Avram that they're about to have Brit Ben Abtarim, the covenant between the pieces, and Avram and Hashem promises Avraham that he'll have many descendants. So it says in the Chumash, Perek Tadvah Pasukei, Ve'yotzeo to achutza ve'yomer habedna shamayim u'sfar kochavim im tuchal yisbar otam ve'yomer lo ko yezarech. He took him outside and showed him the stars and said, your descendants will be as many as the stars. So on the very simple first point, Ve'yotzeo to achutza, Rashi says as follows. Lefi pshuta hotzio me'ohalo lechutz li'rota kochavim. You want to say he took him outside? Let's say the stars. Now, you wonder, well, how do you know that he was inside in the first place? Details. Well, the midrasho amar lo, tsei me'itztagninu chelcha, sh'ra'ita b'mazalot she'incha atid l'hamid bein, Avram in lo bein, aval Avraham yesh lo bein, Sarai lo teleid, aval Sarah teleid. Hotzeo to achutza is not meant literally he took him outside, but rather he said, step outside of your astrological forecast. You have seen in the stars, in the astrologically, that you're not going to have a son. Hashem said, you're right, your fate as Avram, you're not going to have a son. Aha, I challenge your name, and Avraham will have a son. Sarai won't give birth, but Sarai will give birth. The dynamic between inside and out can be interpreted literally or metaphorically. Metaphorically, of course, interests us in this case more. What does it mean that he steps outside? He steps outside of the fate that had been determined from him. The enclosure, the tent, is literal, but also existential, or maybe psychological. Avram had been fated to be trapped. He was closed in. And psychologically, Avram doesn't see a future for himself. Sarah doesn't see a future for herself. They are trapped. They are hemmed in by the fate that they see for themselves. At the moment the Malachim ask, where is Sarah? She is inside the house. She does not see a future for herself. She is trapped. She is closed in. At the moment they announce the birth of Yitzchak, where is she? In the doorway, in that liminal space between inside and out, on the threshold of something new, something unexpected, something she could never have imagined. And what does she do when she stands in the doorway? What is her frame of mind? Again, from a psychological perspective. She does not immediately embrace the munificence of God's blessing and the wonderful promise that she's going to have a child. Instead, she laughs. She's cynical. She has not yet stepped outside of her previous mindset or her previous existential state where she felt trapped and hemmed in. She is still on the threshold, not yet accepting, still torn between the state of being enclosed and hemmed in and the state of stepping outside to an amazing new future. She is on the threshold, and she's cynical, and she laughs. In the story of Abraham and Sarah, the house is an enclosure. It's a confinement. When we now transition to the story of Lot, the house, I think, serves the opposite function. Because if for Sarah and Abraham, possibilities are expanding, things that they never dreamed possible and that naturally shouldn't be possible are suddenly happening to them, exactly the opposite dynamic is going on in Stone. In Stone, all of the things, the future that they're supposed to have, is suddenly receding. Suddenly, reality is about to collapse in on itself, and the only safe place in Stone is the house. At the moment the angels close the door, they pull Lot inside and close the door, everybody outside the house is doomed, everybody inside the house will be saved. The closed space, in the case of Stone, is not an enclosure, is not a confinement, but a sanctuary. When possibilities are expanding, you step outside. When fate has doomed everybody around you but you, you step inside and you close within yourself. There's a sense in which the people of Stone almost intuitively understand what's going on. It's a little eerie and hard to explain, because of course they think that everything's just fine. They think that they're living in the city of endless possibilities, and those possibilities, whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, are going to continue into the indefinite future. Somehow, when the angels close the door, they understand that their one chance of getting out is to get through that door, because what do they do even after the angels blind them? They're still trying to find the door in this twisted, grotesque mindset that is so typical of Stone. They're still groping for the door. Somehow they understand this is their one chance, that this is the only place that there's going to be safe. When Lot steps into the doorway, just as Sarah was standing in the doorway, he too is torn between these two existential states. On the one hand, he's drawn towards Stone and the lifestyle of Stone, the endless possibilities that are about to about to be destroyed. On the other hand, being pulled inside, where his guests, the life of hospitality, everything he learned from Avraham Avinu about welcoming guests and treating them well, Lot himself is a very ambivalent figure and a very ambiguous figure. And that's epitomized by his standing in the doorway, the liminal space between these two places, outside and inside. And Lot feels conflicted. On the one hand, he wants to placate the townspeople. On the other hand, he wants to save his guests. And even in his suggestion, what does he suggest when he's standing in the doorway? He says, "Let me hand over my daughters to you." On the one hand, what's he trying to do? He's trying to protect his guests in an extremely noble way. He's saying, "I will make the ultimate sacrifice and sacrifice my family." On the other hand, in doing so, he's giving in to Stone's grotesque assumptions about what is proper and right, right? He's not actually making the sacrifice himself, he's sacrificing his daughters. He's giving his daughters over to an angry mob to be gang raped. There's something deeply ambiguous about even his actions as he stands in that very liminal space. Ultimately, he doesn't make the decision to go back inside. The angels have to pull him inside, just as the angels are the ones who say, "And you must leave, you must run now." And again, even when they say the city's about to be destroyed, he hesitates, and they have to pull him out of the city. When we get to the final episode in this parsha, the cave, you have to work with me here. I know that our image of the cave is always those like cartoon caves with this big open mouth and you go inside and you make a campfire. My image of a cave is always informed by my own experience when I was Shana Aleph at Shalvim. We went one Friday spelunking in the caves near Herodion. It was a very rainy winter. We crawled through about 5 inches of mud in this tiny crawl space, and you get into the cave and it is black. Pitch black. There is no opening. There is no petach. When Lot and his daughters hide in the cave, they are closed in. They are trapped. They are trapped psychologically. They think there's no one else left on earth. They're trapped existentially. They themselves feel they have no future. And as a result, what do his daughters do in this trapped state where they think they have no alternative? Ironically, they do exactly, or almost exactly, what their father had threatened to do in Stone, which is an act of incest. They get their father drunk and sleep with him. The cave is the ultimate closed space which has no petach, signifying the psychological state that Lot and his daughters find themselves in. And it's ironic, of course. There are many levels of irony to that last story. They escape from Stone, but they are trapped within the closed space. They never actually make it out of their sanctuary into the open world. Okay, the one section of the story that we've passed over is Avraham's debate with God, which stands apart from the rest of the of this whole parsha because it has no physical setting. It's just God and Avraham arguing on a hilltop somewhere overlooking the city of Stone. The strange thing about Avraham's argument with God is that it seems logically inconsistent. When Avraham starts arguing with God, he says, this is Perek Yudchet, Pasuk, Kaf Gimel, Vayigash Avraham Vayomar Ha'af Tisped Tzadikim Rasha, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Logically, what would we expect Avraham to ask for following that accusation?
Save the righteous.
Save the righteous and kill the wicked. That's logically what you should say. That's not what he says. Ulayish chamishim tzadikim b'toch ha'ir, ha'af tispev la tisal ha'makom l'man chamishim tzadikim asher b'kir ba. Won't you save, says Avraham, the whole city on behalf of 50 righteous people? And then again, in Pasuk Kafei, chalil alach me'asot kadavar azeh v'hamid tzadikim rasha v'ayak ha'tzadik ha'rasha. How dare you treat the righteous the same as the wicked? Chalil alach ha'ashofit kol ha'aretz li'asem mishpat. In Pasuk Kaf Hei, he goes back to his original point in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, which is, how can you treat the righteous like the wicked? And yet his entire request seems not to follow logically from that premise, which is, save everybody. I was puzzling over this the first time I was preparing a shiur on this with my chavruta, who's by the name of Jesse Kellerman. You may know his parents, Jonathan and Faye Kellerman, authors of many good mystery novels. He's a wonderful guy. I haven't been in touch with him in many years, and he made a fascinating point, which is very simply, it's all fine and good to talk about theodicy and how God should reward the righteous and punish the wicked, but that's not really how the world works. We all know, and are all very uncomfortable with the fact that there are often sweeping indiscriminate judgments or events that take everybody in one fell swoop. We don't presume to judge anybody in the Holocaust to say that, oh, they were wicked, they deserved it, but we certainly know of many cases of great tzaddikim who were swept away by the great destruction of the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. This is something that makes us deeply uncomfortable. This is something that philosophers and Jewish philosophers have always struggled with, and it resonates, of course, in many instances in Tanakh and the Midrash. Just a few, just in the very next parakut, in fact, when God comes to Avimelech and says Avimelech is going to be punished, Avimelech says, "Who are you? You destroyed everybody in the flood. Why do I think that you have the ethical upper hand here?" this is something that makes us uncomfortable, but it's something that Abraham is very cognizant of. And of all of the various approaches to this problem, the inconsistency in Abraham's request, this is the approach that my friend suggested, is actually the approach that's taken by the Malbim. The Malbim says, why doesn't Abraham argue to save the righteous and kill the wicked? Because, he says, when permission is given to the Malach HaMavet, to the avenging angel to destroy, he does not distinguish between the righteous and the wicked. That's just how the world works. So what does Avraham do? On the one hand, Avraham is demanding mishpat. What is mishpat? That very fine line, that barrier between zechut and chovah, between right and wrong, between good and evil. Avraham wants to stick to that line. And yet he knows that you can never stick to strict mishpat. Things always tend to one side or the other. There are always people who get more than they deserve and people who get less than they deserve. There are always possibilities opening where there shouldn't be and doors closing when they should be open. And Avraham, therefore, tries to push the envelope as far as possible. He tries to stretch that line, that thin line of mishpat, he tries to stretch it as far as he can in the direction of Rachamim, until he gets to 10. If there are 10 people in the city, God says he'll save it, and God isn't willing to go any farther. Ironically, of course, what happens in the end? God does exactly what Avraham Avinu thinks he can't ask for, which is save the righteous and kill the wicked. The only righteous people in the city are Lot and his family, and they are saved. They are magically, miraculously plucked out of the city by the angels, and everybody else in the city is destroyed. But Avraham Avinu doesn't think that that's a reality. He doesn't think that strict mishpat is a possibility. There are two other possibilities that things always tend towards. On the one hand, there is the mode of vayigash. When Avraham comes forward, Rashi picks up on that word vayigash. What does vayigash imply, says Rashi? Vayigash always implies trying to push the envelope, trying to push things further, trying to ask for things you don't deserve. Vayigash Elav Yehuda is one of the examples the Medrash gives. Yehuda comes forward to ask to replace Binyamin, which of course is not something that would be legally not something that would be legally permissible. All of the brothers said they would give themselves over, and Yosef pronounces Binyamin's fate. Yehuda comes forward to ask for mercy, to ask to stretch the limits of mercy beyond what he deserves, beyond what he deserves. We see it again in the people of Sodom. When they come forward to Lot, towards that boundary, the liminal space between inside and out, what does it say? In Perek Yutet, Pasuk. Pasuk Tet, Vayomru Gesh Hala. They said, come here, using the language of Vayigash. Vayomru Echad Balagur Vayishpot Shafot. They say to Lot, you came here to judge us. Lot apparently has established himself in a kind of judicial position in stone where he's tried to impose order on the chaos and evil that is the city of stone. Atan nara lecha mehem, we will now do worse to you. Vayitzeru ba'ish balot me'od, vayigshu lishpor hadalet. Like Avraham, but of course in a grotesque perversion of Avraham, the people of Sodom also come forward. They also draw near to try to push the boundary, to try to push the boundary of Mishpat that Lot represents. On the other side, there is Sfiya, there is the sweeping indiscriminate judgment. When Avraham says, Ha'af tispe tzadikim rasha, will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Sfiya is that mode where people get what they don't deserve. They get a punishment that they are not deserving of simply because the Malach HaMavet has been loosed. And that word Sfiya shows up over and over again in the story. When the angels pull Lot out of the city and they say, run to the hills, they say, Haharahi malei penti safeh, lest you be swept away, they say to Lot. Even though we pulled you out of the city, nothing is guaranteed. You must take responsibility for yourself. You must. I've gone through all that kind of quickly. But if we stop and think about it now, is there anything else I want to say on that? I don't think so. If we stop and think about it now, we see a number of connections between this whole story and the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Most prominently in what image?
Petah.
The doorway. Thank you. The doorway. And if we think about the doorway in Yetzias Mitzrayim, what do the Jews do to the doorway? They paint it red. The doorway is supposed to stand out as a prominent image. Where do they paint the doorway? This is a machlokas in the Farshim. Some say they paint it on the outside to kind of stick to the Egyptians. We're slaughtering your god, we're spreading the blood on the doorway. Or for the when the Melech HaMavis or HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes, he'll see the blood on the doorway, so to speak. Other Mefarshim say, no, they painted it on the inside. Why on the inside? What's the point? Why on the inside? What would that signify?
Warning, do not go outside.
Warning, do not go outside. Because the entire night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jews are not supposed to go outside. From this perspective, the house, the closed space in Yetzias Mitzrayim, is the same as the closed space in stone. It's a sanctuary, it's a refuge. The Jews are safe in their houses. Outside, everyone will be destroyed. Inside, everyone is safe. The doorway is that liminal space across which they may not pass. When we think about the experience of eating Karban Pesach in Yetzias Mitzrayim, the message of stone and the parallel to stone becomes even more pronounced. Because how are the Jews supposed to eat their food? This is a point that's brought up by Aviva Zornberg in her essay in her book on Shemot on Sefer Parshat Kohelet, an excellent book to pick up if you want to do a little exploratory reading for the Seder. She talks about the fact that they had to put on their belts and their walking sticks in their hands and put their walking shoes on. Why are they doing that? They're not going anywhere until the morning. Why are they getting all ready to go? They've got hours and hours to get ready to leave Mitzrayim.
Gotta pack the whole family.
There you go. They've got to hit their lift. What she suggests is it's play acting. When they eat their Karban Pesach and at midnight they hear the screams of the Egyptians, they're supposed to want to feel as if they are going to run now. They're supposed to feel terror. And the belt and the walking shoes and the stick are props to give them the sense that they want to flee now. They're living in a city where every household has somebody dead, where people are dying all around them. They're supposed to feel that terror. And she actually interprets the word chipazon. They're supposed to eat it chipazon, not meaning as haste. After all, again, they're not really going anywhere. They don't have to rush, but as terror, as panic. They're supposed to understand that if not for the fact that HaKadosh Baruch was protecting them, it could have been them. There's supposed to be a feeling of vulnerability, a feeling of panic, a feeling of chaos. Except for the fact that they're closed in their house and they've painted the blood on the doorway and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is passing over their house. That's the feeling they're supposed to have in Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it's very, very vividly portrayed in Lot's experience in stone. When we understand the parallel between Lot between the situation Lot has the night the stone is destroyed and the situation the Jews are in the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we get a very clear sense for what the Jews were feeling and what we're supposed to understand about the experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Come morning, of course, and the imagery is flipped. They walk out of the door into the wide open world, just as Sarah Imenu walks through the doorway into a reality she could never have anticipated. When Bnei Yisrael step outside as free people, it's something they can barely imagine. Suddenly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha has materialized. The freedom they have been promised and been waiting for some years is real. The doorway is, the house is now an enclosure, it's a confinement. When they step outside, the image that we had in stone is reversed. They are now following the model of Sarah Imenu, stepping outside and realizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given them far more than they could have ever anticipated. Our experience in the Seder, of course, is very different. And the Gemara makes a point of saying, of all of the things that we see in Pesach Mitzrayim, there are some that are l'dorot, that are things that we always have for generations, and there are some that are not. And among those that are not, we do not sit around the Seder table with our belts girded and walking shoes on and walking sticks. I know that Spartans have the custom of beating each other with the scallions and pretending there is a degree of play acting at the Seder, but not this. Why not? At the Seder, we are not supposed to feel terror. We are supposed to feel free. We're supposed to feel as if the Geula has already happened. We're not reenacting every aspect of Yetzias Mitzrayim. What are we doing? We're telling the story. When the child comes at the end of Parashat Bo and says that pasuk that we say is the line of the Tam, Ma ha'avodah hazot, sorry, of the Rasha, is it the Rasha? This is the end of Perek Yud Bet Pasuk Kafav. The line that we attribute to the Rasha, but let's leave the Rasha out of it for a minute, because Pshat in the Torah is just the Stam kid asking. Why is the child asking this? He doesn't understand that aspect of Yetzias Mitzrayim that we've just talked about. He doesn't understand the threat, the terror, the panic. We're free. We're living in Eretz Yisrael. What could be so bad? Why are you offering this Korban Pesach? The only way to get it across to him is to tell the story. V'amartem zevach Pesach u'lashem asher pasacha batei b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim v'negpot Yitzrayim et batein huitzil. You have to understand, you say to the child, the threat was real, the panic was real, it could have been us. You have to make the children understand, and we have to understand ourselves, what happened in Mitzrayim, how real the threat was, and how amazing the salvation was. How dependent, how utterly dependent we are on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's salvation. When we read the story of Sarah Imenu and think about the door image, and think about what Sarah Imenu was feeling when she stepped outside of that psychological enclosure, that's the feeling that we're supposed to be giving our children and ultimately to ourselves on the night of the Seder. So when we read through the story in the part of Maggid that Naftali didn't have time to get to, and that we often don't have time to get to, we read the part of the story where we're actually talking about slavery and the tzaka that went up from Mitzrayim, just as the tzaka went up from stone. That's what we're supposed to be emphasizing. This was real. We could have been slaves, and had Kadosh Baruch Hu not taken out of Mitzrayim, we would have been slaves. So I'm sure you said you won't have time to go through all of this, and I hope you. Going back to Sefer Bereishis is probably not Shayach, but I think the understanding the parallels between Sefer Bereishis and the episodes of Sarah and Lot give us much more of a perspective, much deeper perspective on the kinds of messages and the kinds of feelings that we're supposed to be conveying when we sit around the Seder table.